Good morning. Good morning, Your Honor.
We'll hear from you first.
Thank you. May it please the court. In January of 2011, Plaintiff's Leadership Group asked the district court to order common benefit withholding from any, quote, settlement or judgment in Riceland's Arkansas state court action. The Plaintiff's Leadership Group claimed that they should receive common benefit withholding from that state court case on the ground that the claims made by Riceland in its federal court case and its state court case were identical, and the court therefore had jurisdiction over any settlement or judgment. In response at that time, the district court stated that it could not order common benefit withholding for, quote, any recovery obtained in an Arkansas state court case. Riceland and Bayer took that state court case to verdict. Riceland sought nearly $400 million. The jury returned a verdict for $137 million. The Arkansas state court judge entered judgment on that verdict, which the district court here held, and all parties agree, barred further prosecution of Riceland's federal case due to res judicata. Just prior to argument before the Arkansas Supreme Court, Riceland and Bayer settled that state court case for $90 million.
You're telling me Judge Perry considered that she had a federal case with involving the identical claims in the Arkansas case. Is that fair?
Correct. In February of 2011, that was her order.
She considered that.
Correct.
After the verdict, then it came back up again. The whole issue.
Correct. Yeah. Yes.
And at that point, she determined that she had jurisdiction over the federal case involving Riceland and Bayer, because that all those identical claims were in her federal court at that time. Is that fair?
She held that the presence of that federal case gave her jurisdiction over the entire dispute between Riceland and Bayer, which was entirely comprised of a state court case that had gone to judgment.
But it's the same claims. I mean, if I understand the factual scenario, they made the counterclaim in state court, and on the same day or closely thereto, Riceland filed a federal case.
There may be some slight differences, but the same, importantly, sufficient that everyone agrees the state court judgment bars the federal court action from proceeding under res judicata. So same enough, if you will.
But that's res judicata is not necessarily jurisdiction.
No, it's not.
And that's really what we have here, right? I mean, if I'm trying to grasp the issue, it's whether Judge Perry had jurisdiction.
Correct. And she did not have jurisdiction to order common benefit fund withholdings from the state court case, because in her initial common benefit order, she held two important principles. One, she did not have jurisdiction for recoveries related to a state court case. It's at addendum 1 and 2. Corollary, she does have jurisdiction over recoveries related to a federal court case.
But Riceland, in essence, has to concede that Judge Perry has jurisdiction over this facts and matter, because they filed that lawsuit in federal court in the Eastern District of Arkansas.
We differ with Riceland in this regard. Judge Perry has personal jurisdiction over Riceland, both in this claim and also in that there's a separate lawsuit brought by the Plaintiff's Leadership Group for unjust enrichment against Riceland. Yes, Judge Perry, Riceland and Bay are in agreement, though, that Judge Perry does not have jurisdiction to order common benefit fund withholding from recoveries in a state court case, which is what happened here. Look at the record when the settlement agreement was entered into. In federal court, Bayer had an ironclad defense of res judicata if Riceland were to try to move forward with that claim at all. In state court, Bayer faced the real risk of a $137 million verdict before the Arkansas Supreme Court.
Why didn't the settlement agreement, as every other settlement agreement does, list out everything else that has been resolved? Why would it be silent as to a federal case that Riceland had filed against Bayer in federal court?
For two reasons, Your Honor. First, the settlement agreement had a broad all claims, asserted or unasserted, known or unknown. That's part of what Bayer bargained for when it paid Rice on $92 million. In any settlement agreement, there's going to be a broad release of all claims. Secondly, Bayer and Riceland knew that at that moment, judgment was entered in June of 2011. When the settlement agreement was signed, there was no need for a settlement agreement to say, oh, and by the way, you can't bring the federal case. We had the state court judgment, which everyone agrees gave res judicata effect. The settlement agreement gave Bayer no additional protection beyond that it already had from the use of the res judicata judgment.
What did Bayer cross appeal in that state case? Was it just the damages?
Yes.
Or was there an appeal seeking a new trial?
No. Bayer appealed just on the grounds there is a disputed trial between whether it was contributory negligence or comparative fault. And we argued that based on Riceland's arguments and positions at trial, because they were found 30% negligent by the jury for causing their own damages, that meant they couldn't recover anything. Neither side asked for a new trial on appeal. Riceland asked for the full amount of the jury verdict. There was a $125 million punitive award that at the time of the initial state court judgment had been reduced to $1 million.
So Bayer was trying to vacate the judgment against Bayer on the grounds of contributory negligence by Riceland?
We weren't trying to vacate the judgment.
No.
We were trying to say, as a matter of law, Bayer was found negligent, but under Arkansas law, as asserted by Riceland, the consequence of the jury's finding of 30% negligence on Riceland meant that Riceland could not recover.
And therefore, what would happen to the judgment against Bayer?
I believe, I need to confirm in the record, I believe that the consequence would be that the judgment would exist, but Riceland would take no damages because their own negligence.
There'd be a judgment against Bayer for no damages?
I believe that's correct, sir, but I don't know the exact word.
It sounds like you were arguing that there could be no judgment against Bayer because of contributory negligence by Riceland. And if that were to, I just wonder whether that would vacate the judgment against Bayer and affect your res judicata point. But let me ask you a different question. I'm trying to understand the rule that Bayer is proposing here. And it sounds like you're proposing a rule that says in a global settlement like this, the district court has to decide how much of the settlement is attributed to a state court proceeding and how much is attributable to a federal court proceeding.
Not exactly, Your Honor. Based on the record here,
I know what you're saying on the record here is that it's all attributable to state court judgment, but I'm trying to understand the rule that you're proposing so we can understand how it would implicate future cases. Suppose that Riceland had filed these parallel lawsuits, conducted discovery, and then there was a settlement before any case went to trial. For $92 million. What would be the authority of the district court in that case to order a holdback?
I think the court would have clear authority, based on the Rice 1 appeal, to order a holdback for the portion of the settlement that was related to the federal court case.
It
would not have authority to order, based on the holdback, for the portion of recovery related to the state court case.
So how would a court allocate a settlement in that way?
Well, I think, again, that's not this case, but a good rule would be to look at the respective risk faced by the parties in each jurisdiction. Because the settlement isn't an amount of how much work has been done here, in this case or in that case, as the plaintiff leadership group proposes. It is, what is the risk? What is the value of the settlement? The risk that is being taken away from the settling party. And in that case, where there was no state court judgment, where there was proceedings, it would be a difficult exercise, but one that the court could do on a hearing, evidentiary hearing. Here, the plaintiff's leadership group, for instance, says in their reply brief, we can't rely on the parties to allocate because we don't trust them. They will shift it one way or the other.
Well, an obvious incentive to shift it away from the federal case.
Right. But where there's a case where there isn't a rock-solid defense in one forum and a huge jury verdict in another, which is this case, I do think that an evidentiary hearing would be the appropriate way to act, to under the district court to make findings of fact and to allocate between the two. Here, I would note, there was no hearing by the district court. This was decided entirely on the papers. And
are you inferring that there's a rock-solid defense in the federal MDL case on behalf of Riceland, but they chose not to pursue it?
No, a rock-solid defense on behalf of Bayer.
On behalf of Bayer.
Because after that June 2011 state court judgment, which exists to this day, the Arkansas Supreme Court never issued an opinion. They settled on the eve of that argument. If had Bayer or Riceland attempted to move the federal case forward, we would hold up that state court judgment. And Judge Perry agreed, in her opinion, that the district court, that the Arkansas state court judgment had res judicata effect in federal court.
Which all it means is those are identical claims, right? I mean, they were all the same parties, all the same facts, all the same dispute, but Riceland chose to pursue its case or its counterclaim in state court. But all that, if it has res judicata effect, all that same discovery from the state court case, you could have used in the federal court case, right?
Correct. Riceland obtained discovery, extensive discovery in the state court case. And to me, it comes back to the two fundamental jurisdictional points that Judge Perry held and this court agreed in the first Rice opinion, that there is clearly jurisdiction over federal MDL cases to order common benefit withholdings. There is not jurisdiction over state court cases, even though they're related, the parties are identical, and this court makes clear in its opinion when it says, quote, state court cases related or not are not before this district court, and the district court correctly held that it lacked jurisdiction to order holdbacks from state court recoveries.
Why isn't this settlement agreement ambiguous because of this global settlement language? Why doesn't that make the agreement ambiguous because we can't tell from reading the settlement agreement how the settlement proceeds were apportioned under the agreement of the parties?
Well, I think it's not ambiguous because the settlement agreement is focused very much on the state court case, requires Riceland to take certain steps.
But it also provides that one of the things being settled and released are all other claims that may be asserted or have been asserted.
Correct.
Wouldn't the federal action that was pending fall under that?
Absolutely, and I don't think that's ambiguous. We settled all claims.
But what is ambiguous, it seems to me, is you've got $92 million changing hands. What would the settlement have been if Riceland had balked on that provision and said, we're not going to include this global settlement language, we're just settling the state court? Then what would the settlement amount have been?
It would have been exactly the same. Because
how do we know that?
Because we look at the facts as they existed at the time of the settlement agreement. The federal case was worthless. There was no ability to move forward with that case, and there was a judgment in Arkansas that was the subject of appeal. So Judge Shepard, I don't believe that the settlement agreement is ambiguous in this regard. We differ with Riceland. It clearly covers the federal case as well as all other claims related, known and unknown. But it's clear.
Well, why did the parties include a release then? If they knew that there was going to be a fight about the holdback and so forth and the claim was worthless, why did you put in there that the federal claim is also settled as part of this agreement?
Well, it was covered by the all claims language, and there's two reasons why. First, we relied on Judge Perry's clear order in February of 2011 that she did not have jurisdiction to order holdbacks from state
court
recoveries.
But you know that was regarding a state court proceeding standing alone.
She said she did not have jurisdiction to order recovery from state court proceedings.
Yeah, but this $92 million, as I understand it, is not in a state court judgment.
Well, it's in response to a $137 million jury verdict that was on appeal. But we also purchased Global Peace with that settlement. That's why, any defendant.
So there may be some value. You seem to be saying at least there's some value to Global Peace that might be part of the $92 million.
There is some value to Global Peace, that the consideration, that broad release. But there is no value to the federal court case. the settlement agreement gave us absolutely nothing more than we already had with regard to the federal court case. That state court judgment, we did not need the settlement agreement, and had Rison attempted to move that federal court case forward, we had the state court judgment to stop it. What the global release gave us was we didn't know what else, what other claims. There were claims all over the world.
But there was some value to global peace. And Bayer wouldn't have paid $92 million, right?
Without question. But
let me ask you a question about the Eighth Circuit's decision that was handed down in 2014. In particular, the court held the state court plaintiffs at issue neither agreed to be part of the federal MDL nor participated in the MDL settlement agreement. And that's on page 874 mm-hmm. of the court's decision. Help me understand why this isn't different, because here we don't have state court plaintiff. We have Riceland, who is a state court defendant, and here we have Riceland bringing a suit in the MDL, in federal court. So it seems like the facts of this case are different than the holding of the Eighth Circuit 2014.
So Riceland was both a federal court plaintiff and was also a state court plaintiff. Their case they brought, they were a defendant, and then they were a cross plaintiff against Bayer in the state court case. So they were both a state court plaintiff and a federal court plaintiff. And if the following sentence from that opinion that Judge Boo, you read from, where it says, but state court cases, related or not, are not before this district court, if that sentence has any force, it means that the case of Rison v. Bayer in state court is not and cannot be before the federal court and subject to common benefit withholding. And based on the facts as they existed at the time of the settlement, there was no value. The federal court case was worthless. What Bayer bought was specific relief from the state court verdict that was on appeal, $137 million jury verdict, and global peace, which included everything except for this federal court case. There was no additional
value.
Well, it was included in the all claims, we agree, but it gave Bayer no additional protection, the settlement agreement did, because we had the federal, we had res judicata as an ironclad defense in federal court. And so the peace was important, but the peace that Bayer already had a defense to the federal court case. The peace was what we were buying was, you know, we had some administrative proceedings in Europe that involved Riceland that we didn't know about. We had claims made by people all over the world, and we wanted to make sure that when we wrote this $92 million check, which we did, in reliance on the district court's ruling that we didn't have to withhold in state court cases, that the consequence of that was we got global peace. And I'd like to spend a couple minutes on the American rule argument, if we could, because the important consequence of Judge Perry's ruling here, that after Bayer has paid $92 million, that we now have to pay an additional $9.2 million, violates the American rule very clearly, because there's no statutory or contractual basis for her to do that. Now, the plaintiff's leadership group says, ah, but it's okay. That is an appropriate sanction, an appropriate consequence for Bayer not following the common benefit order originally. And it's entirely appropriate for Judge Perry to say the initial payment obligation was on Bayer. Even though it's already paid the money, it should nonetheless be required to pay an additional $9.2 million. But that's not appropriate for two reasons. First, the plaintiffs never sought a sanction against Bayer below. Their brief and argument was against Riceland, that Riceland should disgorge $9.2 million from the settlement, and that only in the alternative should it recover from Bayer. They sought sanctions against Riceland, but not Bayer. And under this court's holding, recent holding in the Jones Day case, Bayer had no advance notice that the consequence for relying in good faith on Judge Perry's February 2011 order was that we would be held to pay an additional $9.2 million to the plaintiff's attorney fees and costs. We had no notice of that, and it can't withstand scrutiny. And most
why do you say it's a sanction? Why isn't it just an enforcement of the pre-existing order?
Because the pre-existing order was silent on consequences for noncompliance, and the pre-existing order also said, in response to our objection to the common benefit order, that there is no, there will be no financial consequence on Bayer. So if in the initial order had said Bayer must withhold 10%, and if Bayer doesn't, Bayer remains liable regardless of any ability to recover from the corpus of the settlement, then we would have appealed that at that time. But Judge Perry said in response to our objection that the common benefit order would have no financial consequence on us. So it's her application of that now to impose a financial consequence, again, for our good faith reliance on a specific order that addressed this particular case.
What the common benefit order said put Bayer on notice about the 10% to go to the common benefit fund. Is that fair?
Well, the common benefit fund said no state cases.
You knew about it.
Yeah, no, of course we did. And we withheld, and we've paid over 50-some million dollars in common benefit funds.
You've affirmatively paid it.
Right.
And but now you say it's silent as to some other things. I mean, wouldn't the better course of action have been to say, Judge Perry, what do we do here? There's this federal case that's identical to the state court counterclaim. What do you want us to do? I mean, as opposed to trying to take advantage of maybe a silence in her order and being silent in the settlement contract. I mean, it seems like we're trying to fit something through here that doesn't seem to give good faith to her orders.
I would invite the court to look closely at the February 2011 order, which is Addendum 24, where the plaintiff's leadership group made that exact argument to Judge Perry and said, we've heard rumors of settlement. Please tell Riceland that we get 10% of any recovery through settlement or judgment. The court said she did not have jurisdiction to do that. The parties had a clear and specific holding from Judge Perry that Riceland and Bayer relied on in not withholding the money. And to come back now and say, oh, but there's this broad release, that within that broad release, though not specifically mentioned, is the federal case, we are therefore going to require Bayer to pay the entire amount of that settlement to the common benefit fund is absolutely inconsistent with the court's prior rulings on
the
limits
of
federal court jurisdiction.
The court had said all along that it was unhappy that Riceland was a free rider, or people in Riceland's position were free riders. But it was hamstrung by this jurisdictional problem. Why isn't it fair to say that the parties gave the district court an opportunity here to avoid the unjust enrichment by including the federal case in this global settlement? Parties knew that if they limited it to a state court proceeding, they were going to be free of the common benefit order. But why isn't it fair to say that the parties basically opened the door and the district court just exercised an opportunity to avoid unjust enrichment?
For two reasons. First, because this court said in the second to last paragraph of the discussion we've been holding, second last sentence, equity is insufficient to overcome limitations on federal jurisdiction.
No, I'm saying why isn't this an opening to jurisdiction by saying the federal case is part of the settlement?
Because if you recognize that fundamental principle that state court cases there's no jurisdiction and federal court cases there is jurisdiction, it cannot be that the entire amount of the settlement is allocated to the federal court, particularly when, as here, well, and at the time that the party signed the settlement agreement, there already was a lawsuit brought by the plaintiff's leadership group against Riceland, pending before Judge Perry, where there's no question there was jurisdiction over that for unjust enrichment. That case is still pending. It's been stayed pending the outcome of this appeal. But respectfully, we believe the proper course is that the limitations on common benefit fund withholding be upheld here, and we be able to rely on the district court's prior ruling. If the court has concerns, as Judge Perry does, about the need for Riceland to disgorge some of its settlement money to the plaintiff leadership group for that work, the appropriate mechanism is to have that case be decided in the case that's already pending, not to expand and contradict this court's prior holding in the Rice case. I see I'm out of time. I would like a couple minutes for rebuttal if I could.
Yes, but you're saying the pending case, remind me, is between Riceland and the plaintiff leadership group?
Yes, the plaintiff leadership group brought a claim against Riceland. Yeah. Riceland brought cross-claim. There was a Rule 54 appeal out of that I believe Judge Shepard was on the panel for.
Right.
But
that's pending in the U.S. District Court now.
It's before Judge Perry, yeah. Yes.
All right.
Thank you very
Thank
much,
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Olson. Let's see. Mr. Hone, I believe you're going to argue next for Riceland. Is that right?
Correct. Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors.
Why don't you let Mr. Olson get seated over there before you start?
Chris Hone, on behalf of appellee and cross-appellant Riceland Foods, Riceland is a farmer-owned agricultural cooperative based in Stuttgart, Arkansas. The district court erred in ordering a holdback on the settlement that related to the Bayer-Riceland state court proceeding, and I think the decision on that begins and ends with this court's 2014 opinion in Rice 1 regarding the common benefit order. In fact, this court focused on the recoveries and the jurisdiction over the recoveries. Specifically, the court held that it lacked jurisdiction to order holdbacks from state court recoveries. In other words, this court was focused on the locus of the recovery and not the lineup of the litigants.
Well, what do you say about this problem of apportionment? How do we know what is a state court recovery in a global settlement, particularly in a case, you know, well, go ahead and address that, but it'd be nice if you could address not just the facts of this case, but any case that involves a global settlement.
Correct, and I would concur with Mr. Olson. I'm not going to repeat that argument. That obviously, in this case, we have a situation with a jury verdict of $137 million, which went up on appeal. That appeal in front of the Arkansas Supreme Court was stayed multiple times, and as the Supreme Court recognized and the litigants recognized in that appeal of the state court case, they were staying that case to settle that case. And so we had a situation where it was a settlement of the state court proceeding. Having already gone to judgment, the federal proceeding was worth $0. But I understand Your Honor's question, which is, in other cases, how do we rectify that? There are certainly a number of other kinds of circumstances that courts confront about allocation, and it comes up in the context of settlements in other cases. Is a settlement allocable to personal injury, you know, which might not be taxable, for example, or to non-personal injury? And I think there are multiple tools that courts can use.
But when you have cases that are identical or basically identical on the same claims, and the settlement includes the federal and the state, regardless of what's happened before that, why shouldn't the district court have authority to prevent unjust enrichment of the plaintiff?
Because, this court said that the principles of equity don't impact the court's jurisdiction.
Right, but if there's a federal case over which the court has jurisdiction that's part of the settlement, and therefore the court has jurisdiction in that sense.
In that sense,
why isn't that jurisdiction enough to avoid unjust enrichment?
There is jurisdiction over the parties. And I don't dispute that. I mean, there was jurisdiction over Riceland and Bayer in federal court. But this court and other courts have said that even if there are related cases, that doesn't mean that the court can tax a state court recovery. And also keep in mind that the court in its common benefit order itself said that any settlements or judgments related to a state court proceeding, I cannot touch and I have no jurisdiction over. I absolutely understand the point, Your Honor, that if there were identical proceedings, identical claims in both fora, in state court and federal court, that you could make that argument. But you carry that argument further than what happens if there wasn't a settlement, but it were a judgment.
Everybody agrees if it was a state court judgment, she can't order a holdback.
Right. If it was just the payment of that judgment, the district court would have no jurisdiction. Well,
but if you have two parallel cases and they settle.
You have two parallel cases and they settle?
Why can't she order a holdback of the settlement amount?
Because, again, this court and other courts have said that it's about the recovery. There's no jurisdiction over the recovery because it is related to a state court case. It is not jurisdiction
some
over
of
the parties.
Related to a federal court case, though, isn't it?
Excuse me?
Said some of the $92 million that changed hands or was going to change hands here is related to settlement of the federal court case, is it not?
No, I would disagree with that.
Why is reference made in the settlement agreement to all claims that have been made?
There were, I mean, there were other claims pending at the time, Your Honor. There was, I mean.
Well, that may be, but wouldn't you agree that the federal court action evidences a claim that had been made?
It was a claim that had been made.
All right.
That was absolutely barred and worthless at the time.
Well, then why is any reference made in the settlement agreement to a category that would include it? Why didn't the settlement agreement carve it out and say this settlement is not related to the federal court case and does not settle that claim? It just seems to me you've got a category that everyone is, so far, the arguments that we've heard, the claim is made, the argument is made that we've got a category in the settlement agreement that covers this federal court action, but then everyone wants to step away from it and argue that it had no value. And I can't get past this question. If it's valueless, if it has no worth, then why is it even covered?
Well, it's not
the position made, taken here today, that it's covered by this settlement agreement.
It's not expressly covered. It's not mentioned. And so we would have had to carve out something that both the parties believed was worthless because there had already been a judgment and thus it was absolutely barred. I mean, Riceland and its counsel could not have proceeded in federal court consistent with Rule 11. I mean, it would have been sanctionable at that time to try and proceed in the federal court case having already secured its judgment.
So you decided rather than carve it out, you'd like to litigate this common benefit order, Matt.
I could think of other better things than to litigate this.
Well, that's the question Judge Shepard's raising. If it was so obvious, why didn't it get carved out? Why did you choose litigation over the common benefit order?
I mean, well, it's counsel, everyone, the lawyers knew that we have this common benefit order.
I think you asked that question of Bayer, and I think that's absolutely Bayer's risk. I mean, Bayer admits in its brief that it understood that there was this dispute, and it understood that it was giving and guaranteeing to Riceland $92 million. It understood it was not covering that in the settlement agreement, and therefore Bayer bears that risk of noncompliance. I think that's ultimately where we get. That's really part of, obviously, our response to Bayer's position that Riceland should have to bear this loss. But you appropriately asked that question of Bayer as to why they did not cover this issue. They didn't, I think, because
Riceland knew about it as well. I mean, they knew the common benefit fund was there and that this theoretically had a risk.
They knew it was there, and it was not covered in the settlement agreement. But also keep in mind, and I would point back to the February 2011 order of Judge Perry, where, again, these same arguments were made. There was the identical federal case pending in federal court and in state court in February 2011 when the issue was addressed in front of Judge Perry, and she said, I don't have jurisdiction. I'm going to repeat what I said in my common benefit order. I do not have jurisdiction. Keep in mind also, and I think this gets back to the risk that Bayer has and that the noncompliance is their risk, is that the common benefit order itself actually advises Bayer that if in a state court proceeding, it has the option to ask the state court judge to go ahead and enter an assessment. It obviously didn't do that. I mean, again, another instance of it bearing the risk of taking this obligation.
Let me ask you a question about the prior order from the Eighth Circuit.
Yes.
It seems like the language is very narrowly tailored, drafted, to say the state court plaintiffs at issue neither agreed to be part of the federal MDL nor participated in the MDL settlement. That's not true of Riceland, because Riceland agreed to be a part of the federal MDL when it filed their federal lawsuit about the same time as it filed its counterclaim. Is that all true?
Slight disagreement with that, Your Honor, which is Riceland actually filed its federal case in the Eastern District of Arkansas federal court. Obviously, that case was tagged by Bayer and taken to the MDL. So whether or not we agreed to be part of the MDL, certainly it was swept into the MDL. But where I would direct Your Honor's attention to page 874 of the court's decision. I absolutely understand what you're reading from.
I got my finger on 874.
Yep, and it goes on. But state court cases related or not are not before the district court case. And that's the sentence right before that. And then if you look at the concluding paragraph, but equity is insufficient to overcome limitations on federal jurisdiction.
But here we have the state court cases, which are identical. You
right.
agree. The Riceland's claim against Bayer in state court is identical to the one it filed in the Eastern District of Arkansas.
Correct.
Were before the district court. Those claims and those parties, Riceland and Bayer, identical, were in front of Judge Perry.
That's true. The identical claims were in front of Judge Perry as in front of Judge Henry in the state court case. That's absolutely true. The concluding holding of the court, though, is the district court correctly held that it lacked jurisdiction to order holdbacks from state court recoveries. Again, this court, and I'm trying to read, obviously, this opinion, obviously, but it's a holdback from a state court recovery. It's not focused on whether the claims are identical or not. The court said there may be related cases between the parties in the two different sets of forums, but it's about the recovery. And this recovery, I think everyone has to admit, as the district court did, it at least relates to the state court case. It's at least arose out of the state court case. I don't think any party can dispute that.
Well, why can't you read the prior opinion to mean related exclusively to state court recovery?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't say that, obviously.
But this issue wasn't before the court then. Why shouldn't it be construed or reformulated in that way?
I think you do have problems ultimately with federalism, Your Honor. If we get into a situation, because again, the Judge Perry had instructed Bayer, if they had issues, they could go before Judge Henry in state court and say, "Hey, we've got this settlement, but we have this concern about this holdback." The judge had instructed them what to do. What if we have a situation where there's, the federal court is asked to assess, and we also have the state court being asked to assess a recovery? I think this Eighth Circuit, this court, drew the line and said, if it's related to a state court proceeding, then there's no jurisdiction. At least that's how I've read it.
Well, I'm just worried whether you're asking for an impractical rule. I mean, suppose you have the pretrial settlement where you have the two parallel cases. I don't understand how you think a district court is supposed to decide how much of the settlement goes to the federal case and how much goes to the state case. Why shouldn't the court be able to say Riceland could have pursued this in either forum and it benefited from the leadership group work, and so we're going to apply the common benefit order to this amount? What would be wrong with that?
Well, I think, number one, you seem to be using the amount of the common benefit work as sort of the basis for the valuations. What I think it would have to be, and I would concur with Mr. Olson on this, is that it would have to be what's the respective values, the respective settlement values of the two cases. And I think you could hold an evidence. I think a district court could hold an evidentiary hearing and come up with an allocation between two proceedings. Obviously, in this case,
if the two are mutually exclusive, you have to pick one or the other, and the plaintiff is going to recover in one or the other. What's wrong with attributing all of it to the federal case in order to avoid unjust enrichment, since there's jurisdiction over the federal case?
Well, I think the better approach, Your Honor, would be to avoid those issues of trying to determine what's state and what's federal. The way, and I understand the...
Well, I thought that was a rule you're proposing. Well, you have to decide what's state and what's federal.
I think you could perform
How
an allocation.
How do we avoid it?
That, I think you could perform an allocation, Your Honor. I think in the instance, the hypothetical you've drawn, which is not in this record before this court, is two parallel proceedings like that, which are mutually exclusive. I suppose the court could look at it and try and determine whether the settlement was the settlement leveraged because of the presence of that case in one forum or another. I think in this case you would, for example, if you looked at the facts of this case, Riceland litigated its case to conclusion in Stuttgart, Arkansas, where it's headquartered. So you could argue that there was more leverage for settlement because the case was pending there versus in St. Louis, Missouri. So if you had the hypothetical that you addressed, maybe there would be a way to say that what really drove the settlement was the case pending in one particular form or another. Maybe there had been some pretrial rulings in one case or the other that had impacted the value. I think there would be ways to do that. I do think it's best to avoid, but in a situation where you're asking me if there's a way to do it, there would be a way to allocate.
Well, how do you think we should avoid it?
Well, in this case, you don't have to worry about it because the district court ascribed $92 million to a federal court case that was dead, that we would have been sanctioned for proceeding with. And so, the value there was zero. And so I don't think in this case we don't have that problem. I do want to take one issue that Bayer mentioned too, and this goes to their point to try and foist this obligation under the common benefit order back on Riesland. They were quoting the common benefit order where they said that Judge Perry assured there would be no financial consequence on Bayer. Well, that's actually not what the common benefit order says. It says there would be no financial consequence to the establishment of a common benefit trust. Okay? And so back to your point, Judge Colleton, which I don't, this is not in a, you know, having Bayer pay this is not in a sanction. It's not, it doesn't implicate the American rule. It's not an award of fees. It is simply the result of them not complying with what the court determined was their holdback obligation. It is, Bayer took the risk that of noncompliance. The court determined noncompliance. If this court agrees, it is Bayer that ultimately bears that risk.
The district court, in its order that gives rise to this appeal, found that this settlement agreement was unambiguous. What would be the result if the court determined that that was in error, that the settlement agreement is ambiguous? What happens then? What would be the proper course of action?
I think if it were ambiguous, then I think that there would be evidence would need to be taken as to the meaning. I think I don't think it's ambiguous. I think you have the two parties that executed the settlement agreement indicating to you what the intent is.
But if it were, and there needed to be, so you're saying there would need to be some fact finding, evidence produced, and fact finding.
If this court were to find that it was ambiguous, obviously I don't think the district court did not.
Well, I understand, but if it were ambiguous, and there was this necessity for fact finding by the district court here, isn't that something that's very practical and very doable?
I guess ambiguous in what regard? As to whether the federal case were covered? As to whether the federal case was covered? I think ultimately whether it's ambiguous or not doesn't ultimately matter in this specific case because, again, the federal case did not have settlement value. The district court found apparently $92 million worth of settlement value in a case that was dead. But I don't think in this case that ambiguity that you're asking me about really would necessitate that because the case is valueless, and I think Bayer and Rex
would agree. Is it fair to say the district court found $92 million of settlement value in a case that was dead, or did the district court say the parties have formulated a global agreement that gives me jurisdiction to allocate some of the settlement?
Well, but she didn't allocate some of the settlement. I mean, she didn't perform a jurisdictional allocation, which I think courts have done and can do. She did not do that here. And so I do think that by necessity she found $92 million with the value to the federal case.
I understand.
Yeah.
All right, Mr. Hone. Thank you for your argument. Let's see, Mr. Hilton. We'll hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Todd Hilton on behalf of Common Benefit Attorneys below. We're here today to decide whether or not Chief Judge Perry below had jurisdiction to enter an order enforcing her prior common benefit order to the settlement that these two parties entered into that resolved all pending claims, any pending claims, between Bayer and Riesland. The court below found it did have jurisdiction, and neither Bayer nor Riesland have put forth any rule of law or facts today or in their briefs, below or here, to cause this court to believe that the court did not have jurisdiction below. The court had original jurisdiction below over Riesland versus Bayer because Riesland chose long ago to take advantage of both forms. It was a defendant and state court plaintiff, and at that time, it was also a defendant and state court plaintiff in federal court. But it took one step further. Riesland voluntarily chose to sue Bayer on its own in federal court. That case was ultimately transferred to the federal court, and neither Bayer nor Reisland ever once objected to that case being transferred to the federal court. In fact, both Bayer and Reisland actively litigated that case in federal court. Reisland and Bayer believe that because there were few entries in the Reisland versus Bayer case alone on the docket, that somehow that shows that that case was never litigated. Most of that was litigated, but it was litigated on behalf of Reisland by the common benefit attorneys below. Common benefit attorneys multiple times moved for summary judgment on Bayer's affirmative defenses in all cases, including in Reisland's case, and won on several of those arguments. Bayer, likewise, moved for federal preemption across all cases, including the Reisland versus Bayer case. Common benefit attorneys, not Reisland's attorneys, they were paying by the hour to represent them, but the common benefit attorneys responded and won all of those before the district court below. In addition, besides that, all of the common benefit work that common benefit attorneys were doing at the time, written discovery responses, were all provided to Bayer.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Hill.
Yes, sir.
It seems like Judge Perry has said the Reisland-Bayer settlement resolved the pending federal litigation. That seems to be unambiguous out of the settlement agreement. Would you agree?
Yes, agreed. I think all parties here agree that the settlement agreement itself is unambiguous and that there is no question that it resolved the pending federal litigation, Reisland versus Bayer, before Judge Perry below.
The other question I have for you, we hear from both Reisland and Bayer talking about the federal case, I guess the second the settlement agreement was signed, became worthless. The federal case is worthless the date the settlement agreement is signed. Do you agree with that?
No, and for several reasons. One, the question is, even had it been worthless or had there been some diminished value to that federal case, that does not defeat and does not limit the court's jurisdiction in Reisland versus Bayer. So even if it were, it wouldn't matter because it does not deprive the court of the jurisdiction of both entering its CBO order and enforcing that CBO in the federal action that was still pending between Bayer and Reisland in that case.
Well, how can we agree with that consistent with her 2011 order? Would we have to say the 2011 order was wrong if we adopt that analysis?
No, Your Honor. And the reason why is this. In 2011,
there was a federal case pending then.
In 2011, that federal case existed. But there was no settlement at that time, and there was no judgment at that time in the state court case or in the federal case.
But I thought she was saying if there is a settlement in the state court case for, say, $92 million, I cannot order a holdback of a percentage of that, even though I have a federal case pending
with
the same claims.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Isn't that what she said? And
I think if I recall the word she used, I don't have it right in front of me. I believe the word she used was recovery in the state court case. And I believe both her reference in that order and I think the court's reference in Rice 1 can be interpreted as exclusively in that case. She also, and the reason why I say it should be viewed in that manner is because in that 2011 memorandum and opinion, Chief Judge Perry informs both Reisland and Bayer and the common benefit attorneys that anything that Reisland receives and gets in its federal MDL case, Reisland versus Bayer, will be subject to the CBO.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Hilton. This court, the Eighth Circuit, held in 2014 that notwithstanding 28 U.S.C. 1407, the district court does not have the power to order parties in cases not before it to contribute to the fund. That seems to be the opposite of the scenario that we have here today.
It is the opposite scenario that we have today, and the reason why was because that was the opposite scenario in Rice 1. In Rice 1, it was another group of plaintiffs' attorneys who appealed both the 2010 common benefit order and the 2010 disbursement of common benefit attorneys' fees. That group of attorneys represented a few MDL plaintiffs. That group of attorneys that had thousands, I believe it was approximately 2,000, I think, that were state court-only plaintiffs in that case. State court-only. No corresponding federal case before Judge Perry or ultimately this court. And that's the reason why this court held and had that precise language. Here we have the opposite of that. We have Riceland versus Bear, both parties before the district court. We have their attorneys both before the district court, and a common benefit order entered in that federal court. Now, it just so happens that, again, going back to what I was talking about earlier, Riceland also chose to litigate those same claims against that same defendant in state court also.
Well, suppose the $136 million verdict had been affirmed and that was the final judgment. Now, I understand the 2011 order says I cannot order a holdback from that. Do you think that was wrong because there's jurisdiction over the federal case?
I think because of the jurisdiction over the federal case, because of her ancillary jurisdiction with respect to attorney's fees, and because of her then existing common benefit order, I think the court could have arguably, taken at minimum an evidentiary hearing on that state court judgment to determine whether or not any of that was, quote, related to the federal case.
So you think there should have been an apportionment?
Under your example, had there been just a judgment and there was no voluntary settlement agreement that unambiguously resolves the federal case, okay, so restricted yes. to that, I think the court could have had the parties ask for it. Here, no party ever asked for an evidentiary hearing. No party, Bear and Riceland, have never once submitted facts sufficient to the district court to let the district court figure out what type of allocation, if any, should be made between the state court and the federal court. But I think had the parties, in your example, Judge Colleton, if it were just a judgment, all other facts being the same in this case, if it were just the judgment, had the parties requested an evidentiary hearing on that, I think it would have been within the discretion of the district court to have such an evidentiary hearing and for the parties to put on evidence about what allocation could or should be done in that scenario.
All right. So then why on the, if I could just ask one more question, Judge Shepard, on this $92 million, why shouldn't the district court be required to do a similar thing here and say, well, given the lay of the land in this case, there was a state court judgment, $136 million. The federal case would have been barred by res judicata. So some substantial part of that $92 million is allocated, so to speak, to the state court case. And some part to the federal case, and the CBO only applies to the federal part. What's wrong with that?
Judge Colleton has asked my question that I was about to ask.
Yes, Your Honor. So for both you, Judge Shepard, and you, Judge Colleton, the response, I think, goes back to the factual scenario I was describing before, which is this. One, neither of these parties, neither Riceland nor Bear, ever requested any type of allocation below of the district court.
Well, that's because they say the federal case was worth zero, so there was no need for an allocation.
Now, Of course, Bayer's attorney stood up here today and said just the opposite to the court, which is namely that there was some amount of money. There was some amount of money worth at minimum the piece that they bought because of it in those, quote, any and all other cases.
So your answer is waiver? Is that the only answer you have?
First, I think waiver. Second is I think these parties both voluntarily agreed, and they drafted that settlement agreement. That settlement agreement says $92 million will be exchanged in exchange for a release of any and all claims. They could have, had they wanted to, they, as your honors have previously asked, they could have tried to allocate in that settlement agreement. They chose not to. For whatever reason, we don't know, but for whatever reason, they chose not to. And the district court, looking at the four corners of that document, said it's unambiguous. Nobody claims it to be ambiguous. And I believe $92 million was the amount, and I'm going to assess 10%, my 10% common benefit order, which I have jurisdiction to do, to that amount. And again, Your Honor, the other practical aspect of this is what would be the standard to decide such an allocation if such an allocation were permissible and the court should have a hearing on it. Here, the only facts that we have are that Riceland and Bayer were fighting in numerous cases concurrently in federal court, in state court other than in Mines, and in Mines. All of that work was going on simultaneously. Common benefit attorneys, their position and their argument, as outlined below, which was also before the district court. This evidence was not submitted to the district court, but it was before the district court, and that is in the Downing versus Riceland, pending before the state court. It is now stayed, pending resolution by this court of Riceland versus Bayer and the MDL case. But in that case, the common benefit attorneys have ascribed a host of work that they did to benefit Riceland, and that Riceland did in fact use in its Mines trial. Those are outlined in our brief, including besides, we took 167 depositions in the case. Riceland took, they did not send their attorneys to all of those depositions. In fact, they sent to far less than half of those depositions. They got the transcripts from all of those depositions. They used many of those depositions in their trial in the Mines case. And in fact, what that equated to in the Mines case, in their opening, in their case in chief, and in their closing, okay, those entirety portions of the Mines transcript, 17% of that entire trial was common benefit attorneys examining Bayer witnesses.
Let me ask you a question.
Videotape deposition of my clients examining Bayer witnesses.
Let me ask you a question about this allocution.
Yes, sir.
Everybody agrees that this state court litigation and the settlement agreement that was crafted resolved all the federal litigation as well, that they were trying to purchase global peace. It would seem to me that Judge Perry at some point had to make an arbitrary decision, which was 10%, and that was made earlier, and there's not been anybody fighting about it, but that she would have to, in essence, revisit that 10% decision, that she's already gone through and looked at the numbers and in her wisdom decided, well, 10% is the common benefit fund. And here we have identical cases, state and federal, and it seems to be her opinion, at least, that you resolve the federal litigation, then you're subject to my prior order.
Correct. That's no question that that's what the district court held below. And at the time, in real time when all of this was going on, All parties on the 2010 common benefit order, the court specifically set out deadlines and gave all the parties notice to have an opportunity to object to the CBO and to file oppositions to the CBO or to file support for the CBO. During this entire time, Riceland never once, not once, to this date, has Riceland ever stated an objection to the court's jurisdiction.
So here's my real concern that I want to kind of get to. If we set out a new rule of law about how to take federal and state, wouldn't that, in essence, create a nightmare for every MDL district judge to have plaintiffs and defendants fighting about allocation of monies between cases?
No question about it. It would be an absolute nightmare. And that goes for all of these issues, okay? To set it up so that a court must have a hearing, an evidentiary hearing, where the parties can come before it and talk about allocations of any kind and somehow challenge the previous CBO entered in that case, makes an absolute mockery of her authority, one, to enter the CBO in the first place when no party objected to it on those grounds.
Well, suppose the settlement agreement included some claims that had nothing to do with the MDL litigation. Why wouldn't it make a mockery to say that
your lawyers get a cut of that amount if that's part of the $92 million? Why wouldn't that? I'm just worried whether you can set a rule that says we'll never have an allocation hearing because you could run into that scenario.
I'm not recommending that the court set any type of precedent that a court cannot have.
Well, you said it would make a mockery of her authority or something like that.
To let in this case the parties come before the court and never have asked the district court, never to have informed the district court below that they wanted an evidentiary hearing or that they wanted to provide any evidence related to such allocution. And then for this court to say that we need to go back and have an evidentiary hearing to do that, I think makes a mockery of both her original CBO and of what was already done before, because she was never asked to do that. I think if what Your Honor is asking is, going into the future, if district court judges, if this case were to come up again under similar circumstances, should the district court have an evidentiary hearing about allocation of a specific amount in such a circumstance, maybe that makes sense. That's not the case here, i.e., it doesn't resolve anything other than precisely what was before the district court below, namely the federal case.
All right. You want to close? I think your time has expired.
Sure. Just real quick, I think to permit or say that the district court below does not have federal jurisdiction to enforce its order sets up an absolute disaster going forward and a roadmap for both plaintiffs and defendants.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hilton.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let's see. Mr. Olson, your time expired, and you asked for a couple minutes in rebuttal. So I'll give you a couple minutes in rebuttal with the panel's indulgence.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court, three quick points in rebuttal. First, I want to correct my brother on his assertion that we have given value to the federal claim. We've been steadfast in our position before Judge Perry and here in this court that the federal claim brought by Riceland was worth zero. That is worthless because not of the settlement agreement, but because of the state court judgment that was entered in June of 2011. A hearing is not necessary. Riceland and Bayer argued it was worthless. If the court erred in ascribing any value to that federal case, then this court, of course, has discretion to remand. But the parties took a position that it was worthless and explained why that was. And Mr. Hilton's arguments about the number of depositions taken, all the work that had been done in the federal case, the preemption motion, those are all arguments for a different case, for the unjust enrichment case. In other words, did the work of those common benefit attorneys benefit Riceland? That's not a jurisdictional question over the scope of the court's jurisdiction to order recoveries from a state court case. And to your several questions, Judge Colleton, about what the rule is going forward, I disagree with Mr. Hilton's assessment, and I would ask that the court look to a case where he is lead counsel for an example of how a court can handle this. In the Syngenta contamination litigation that's going on right now before Judge Lungstrom in Kansas, the judge entered the same, adopted the same rule that it was a case-specific inquiry. State cases did not have to withhold. Federal cases did have to withhold under the common benefit order. But he set forth a mechanism that encouraged state court judges to sign on to the common benefit order by requiring the federal plaintiffs to work cooperatively with those state court plaintiffs. And it's docket entry 1099 in that case. And that's the way to go forward. And importantly,
what does that have to do with how to handle settlements?
Or
are you just saying that would eliminate the – I don't understand.
Well, so it shows that the bright line that this court has already adopted of case-specific jurisdiction is easily administrable, does not create a nightmare, as Mr. Hilton asserted. And importantly, the arrangement that arises here is very, very rare in any MDL. Typically, there's a large mass of state court plaintiffs and a large mass of federal court plaintiffs. This is the rare case where the same plaintiff is in both federal and state court. And I would urge this court to focus on the practical realities here. It was a massive, sprawling, complex litigation, claims pending all over the country, with a federal MDL. We took an order from that federal MDL court, February 2011, on this exact issue. The parties relied on that order to settle the case. We didn't come back and say, the plaintiff's leadership group yet again is raising an objection. I mean, the only appeals in this case have been three appeals based on attorney fee claims from the plaintiff's leadership group. We tried to handle things efficiently and relied on the district court's prior action. And we asked the court reverse the order of the district court and hold that common benefit funds were not appropriately withheld.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ellison. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will file an opinion in due course. Thank you,
Your Honor.
You okay to go on, Bob?
Sure.
Yes, sir. All right. Please call the next case for argument.
Crystal Gann v. Household Life Insurance Company.